Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. I'm Aidan Williams, and this is part two of our Andy Gray interview podcast. If you haven't heard part one, please go and give that a listen for the earlier parts of his career. But now we're going to get into the second part of Andy's career and his career after football.
Now, I guess it's the age I am, or I guess more importantly, the age I was at the time. But I recall you best, Andy, in the blue of Everton. That's just the age I was. The great partnership you had with Graham Sharp up front, of course, the fabulously strong, exciting team that you were part of. Scoring in the FA Cup final win, winning the league, winning the European Cup Winners' Cup, having scored a hat-trick in the quarter-final, the epic semi-final, second leg in particular against Bayern Munich, and then you scored again, of course, in the final itself. Was this the greatest team you played in? And what was it that made it so special? At the risk of Paul going off on a major Everton tangent here, but you crack on first, Andy.
What made it special? The gaffer, Howard, Colin Harvey, Mick Eaton, started with them. And then, I tell you what made it happen as well, luck as well, because you have to have luck somewhere. I mean, Paul will tell you by, you know, November sort of 83, it looked like we might be going down. I mean, we're bottom four or five in the league and absolutely going nowhere. And you're thinking, what the hell are we going to get with next win? I remember a horrendous game we played against Coventry, 0-0. It was awful.
It was on New Year's Eve, Andy. It was New Year's Eve that game against Coventry City.
Was it?
Yeah. And the...
Wow.
And the gate was 13,000. I think it was the lowest league gate of the season. And I was at the game with a couple of friends.
There were no signs that anything was happening.
No, there wasn't. And the week before the Coventry game, 4 days before the Coventry game, we'd lost 3-0 at Wolves. And I think the Wolves fans were giving you a bit of stick at the time, chance that Andy was to score.
Yeah, yeah. And Howard made me captain that day. Fucking idiot. I knew he shouldn't have done that. What a bad mistake. No, but what made it a great team? I don't know what made it a great team. The right people. If I look back now, and what was important? Okay, leadership from the top was important. That was there, on the pitch. And I remember Graeme Souness saying to me one day, "You're only as good as your senior players. If they're the wrong type, then you've got no chance." And we at Everton had two, me and Reedy, who were the right type. I loved Reedy from the minute I walked into the club. He was my kind of guy. He hated losing like me, wanted to win, would run through a brick wall to get a victory. And Howard had found his feet and was just beginning to make decisions. He finally said, "Okay, Neville Southall, you're my number one goalie. So, Jim Arnold, I'm sorry, you're going to have to step down." And then introduced people like Trevor Stephen and Kevin Sheedy and Kevin Ratcliffe, who had been a bit part player and became the most successful skipper ever of Everton. Derek Mountfield, who we'd never seen much of. Adrian, who they bought from Stoke City. Kevin Richardson, Alan Harper in that first year before they got people in. So, and it was a case of the collective. I always stress the importance of being together. We talked about that earlier on the show, about you need to be a team player, and I always was. And Reedy and I would instill in the boys on the pitch that it's not quite like winning. And if you want to win, you sometimes have to go out and fight for your mate. And we did all of those things. If it got ugly, we could fight and scratch and kick with the best of them. If they didn't, we could certainly play with the people there. Gary Stevens as well had just burst onto the scene as a right back. He was sensational. You know, we had Bales at left back, who would lose his place the next year to Pat Van der Hal. But that was an improvement, and Bales knows it. So it was like a great setup, great club, and a bunch of players that just came together at the right time. It's like, do you know when people talk about a perfect storm? I think that was it for Howard, because he was under pressure when I went. He were talking about sacking him. There was petitions out. Kendall must go. And then all of a sudden it flipped. And I say there's the Oxford game. Paul will remember it. That's mentioned. I also think there was a game at we played in the FA Cup against Stoke away, beginning of January that year, when Howard just opened the windows of the dressing room and the fucking noise of the Evertonians came flying in. He said, you going to let these down? No, boss. And we beat them, went on and won the FA Cup that year. But it was like that. It was like a perfect storm coming together. And there's nothing any of us, any one of the 11 that was playing, there's nothing any one of them wouldn't have done for the others if needed to win a game. Plus, you had a lot of ability, a huge amount of ability. And it was hard to cope. We were really good those days. We were so good. So good.
I know we were, Andy. It brings tears to my eyes now when I look where we are now compared to where we were then. But you know, going back to the cup run, the 83-4 cup run, obviously it was difficult for you because you weren't in the League Cup team, so you weren't playing every week whereas the others were. And I remember, you know, you were quite upset when Howard dropped you from on the replays against Gillingham, and you were almost on the verge of walking out. Do you want to talk us through what happened there?
Yeah, I remember. Well, I'd been cup tied by Wolves in the League Cup, so I couldn't play, and obviously in the FA Cup I could. So I used to watch the boys. We got to the final of the League Cup. Obviously, Liverpool beat us at Main Road. Was it Main Road, yeah? Beat us at Main Road in that game. So I thought the boys were stung by that. Things like that. You know, defeat. If you don't learn from defeat, you're not going anywhere. And I think the young lads learnt from that defeat and didn't like it. And I made a point of saying, remember that. Just remember that defeat. Remember how you felt. Don't forget it. Take it with you and use it for motivation. And they did. And I think that we played Gillingham, terrible game. We should have lost. I think the first game we should have lost. We should have. No, first replay we should have lost, was it? We played them at home, and then we played them down there. And remember, Tony Cascarino's through in the last minute. It's 0-0, last minute. And Tony Cascarino's through on goal, big Nev to beat. And like he did, the big man was not for shifting, and he saved us, and it went, and we played again. But when he left me out that day, the first game, the first time I'd ever been dropped in my life, not out because I was injured, but actually dropped, even though I was fit. So I couldn't process it very well, but I did, and I bit my tongue, and the next replay was down there, and we won 3-0, and although I didn't score, I created all the goals. I remember Howard on the bus saying, oh, fuck it, I've never dropped you again, never dropped you again. I said, no. You definitely can't say that, Howard. Because you just don't know what you can and what you can't do in this game. But he was delighted. But that was, the first time I'd ever been dropped was Howard. And then he brought me back. But that was him. He was big enough to say, you know what, I made a mistake. Shouldn't have left you out. But he did the right thing in the second replay, and we got past him.
Because I remember, Andy, you talked before about using your experience as, you know, the seasoned professional at the side. And the following season, when Graham Sharp was dropped for the Newcastle game, he was on the verge of handing in a transfer request, and you talked him out of it.
Yes, I know, because, you know, when that second season started, and there was a lot of talk about Inchie, Sharpie and me, you know, 382 doesn't go. And I had been injured at the beginning of the season, so I missed the Charity Shield and I missed first couple of games of the season, and then we went to play Newcastle away. And Howard named the team early, and Sharpie was getting furious. Every right to be, but he was steaming. He said, that's fucking it, I've had enough, I'm off, I'm getting out of here. And I'm saying, no, I was rooming with him, I think. I said, just settle down. I said, I've been in this game a lot longer than you, Sharpie. I know how quickly it can change, so don't do anything rash. And he went, all right. I said, promise me. Give it a week at least. He said, all right, I promise you. I went, good. And lo and behold, I bust my metatarsal in that game that we won 3-2. And yes, I did score the winner. But in the process of looking after Adrian Heath, and she came to me halfway through the game. She says, Glenn Roder's kicking lumps at me, Andy. Can you sort him out? And I went, okay, leave it with me. And he was just about to play the ball back to his goalie. And I absolutely whacked him. I took the lot from behind. But sadly, when my left foot made contact with him, he'd just lifted his boot. So I hit the bottom of his boot with all his studs right on the top of my boot. And I just felt this thing go. And I thought, oh, shit. I stayed on. Never went off, though. I stayed on and we won the game. But when I came in, my foot was killing me. And as it transpired, I'd fractured the metatarsals on the top of your foot. I was out. Sharpie was back in. And they went on for I don't know how many games to be the best front two in the country by a country mile. A country mile. They were brilliant together.
Looking back at the 45 season, Andy, and you mentioned, obviously, you know, when you came back from injury, it was Sharpie and Inchie played up front together. So you'd have been at that Sheffield Wednesday game when that tackle from Brian Marwood took Agent Heath out. Well, what was your thoughts when you first saw us at the time, that tackle?
I just thought it only looked a clumsy tackle. I mean, Brian Marwood was not a dirty player. He didn't have a reputation for clubbing people. I think Inchie went in, he stretched it for a ball, he's letting in, and he caught it, sort of went in between his legs. And then it just went there. But I don't think Brian Marwood would ever be accused of doing Inchie. I think it was just an unfortunate accident. Unfortunate for Inchie, fortunate for me. So, you know, it's a bit, that's football. I mean, I'd missed so many games through injury. You know, I had a huge sympathy with Inchie because of the stuff that I'd gone through. But I had to take my chance. And what was, I think that was about the November, wasn't it? That game. I remember the Echo. And the next couple of days saying, that's it. Everton's chances of a league title gone. Front two split up. Andy Gray's not Adrian Heath. He's a totally different player. Him and Sharp, too similar. They won't be able to play together. Blah, 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 blah. So I pulled Sharpie the next week. Him and I sat and I said, listen, son. And being two Scots, there was a huge affinity and he was a good pal of mine anyway. I says, we've got some work to do. He went, oh, you bet. He says, you're confident? He said, yep. I said, good, so am I. I said, let's show them that we can play together and we can win the league. And he went, yeah, I'm up for that. So that was hugely satisfying for me and Sharpie on a personal note. At a time when Inchie's injury happened, they, as I say, they were the best front two in the country, bar none. And when that happened, it looked like Everton's title charge would come grind to a halt, and in actual fact it didn't. So for me it was hugely satisfying.
So did Howard Kendall change the style of play then? Because obviously, you know, Sharp and Heath.
No, you knew us in those days. We played really fast attacking football. We never messed about, we never passed it across the back too often. We had two unbelievably fit fullbacks and Psycho Pat and Gary Stevens. And we had the quickest back four in the country. You know, they were like, they could catch pigeons. So we could defend at the halfway line, knowing that we're never going to get done by pace. And, you know, the combination of the team was still the same. Sheedy one side, Trevor Stephen the other, great quality coming in. You know, Brace and Reedy in that midfield doing everything it needed. And then Sharpie and I, and it just, you know, it was important for us. Yes, we missed Adrian, no doubt about that. Different team without him. But it didn't make us any less potent. It just made it slightly different. But the rest of the team functioned in the same way. Still got it. And in fact, we probably crossed even more balls when I played with Sharpie than we did with Inchie. Because that was a great supply line. Two fantastic fullbacks, two brilliant wide players. Why not give us a supply? And they did, to be fair to them. They did.
And Andy, did it make a difference? Because you switched to the number 9 shirt, didn't you, away against Leicester City, because you've been wearing the number 8 shirt. I remember you maybe crashed into the post when you scored one of the goals.
I always thought there was two shit numbers when you played football. One was number 2, and well, 3. One was 2 and one was 3, and the other was 8. I never liked 8, ever. And Sharpie wouldn't give me, when I got back in, Sharpie said, I ain't giving you 9. I said, come on, I'm older than you. I'm about to the experience. No, I'm wearing 9. I've been playing well with 9. So I went, oh, okay then. So I went, and I know what it was. I think it was 13 games wearing 8. And although we won them all, I never scored. And I'm going potty by now. He got injured just before we played Leicester, Filbert Street, massive game. And he was out. So I grabbed the 9, put it on. And it's a true story. Put it on. And as you'll know, Paul, I got 2 goals. We won the game 2-1. Fuck me. And I'm thinking, see? Told you it was a number. So then Sharpie comes in. 9. I'm wearing the 9 from now on, Sharpie. Get 8 on. So I never gave him the 9 back between then. But it's amazing football. How does that happen?
So, I mean, I know you've been asked loads and loads of times about the Bayern Munich game, Andy, and you've referred to it before. So is that we drew on the first leg 0-0. It was a defensive masterclass. And then, you know, Bayern got the first goal. It's the away goal. I remember half time we were all talking, thinking that away goals killed us. What was the attitude of the team? Was it, you know, was it, we're going to come out and say we can still do this? I remember Howard says something like, if you get the first goal, the crowd will suck the goals. Is that kind of how it went?
I mean, half time was quite calm, even though we lost that stupid goal. And we'd played all right first half. We really had. Couldn't get a goal. But Howard was cool as you like, him and Colin. They were just emphasising how well we'd played rather than they were focusing on the positive, not the negative. You know, we've played well. We're unlucky not to have scored. We just need to keep it going. Just need to up the tempo a wee bit. They didn't fancy Bayern Munich would like the physicality that we could produce. And we did that night. I mean, that's as brutal a game as I've played in. I mean, it was brutal. There was fucking tackles going in from everywhere. There was elbows flying about, mainly mine. And it was an unbelievable battle. And we talked about it many times. Reedy's, if you look at the pictures, it looks like Reedy's got a red sock on, but it's just blood that had seeped through a big hole in his, near his shin where he wouldn't go off and get it stitched. So he just rammed a piece of cotton wool into the hole in his leg and pulled his sock up. You talk about what made us special. There you are. There's an example of what made us special. And we absolutely battered them. And I mean battered them, physically battered them. And they couldn't, I mean, we got two goals from long throws. I mean, you know, this wasn't like a masterclass of football. This was, as I said to you, we knew how to get the job done. We could play good football. The third goal was a great goal. Trevor's goal that clinched it 3-1. That was a fantastic goal in anybody's language. But the first two came from long throw-ins that they couldn't deal with us. And we knew that. And I think I hadn't played in the first leg and neither had Sheeds. So that was a big plus for us because they hadn't seen me and Sheeds playing. And we came back for that game. We'd both been injured in Germany. And it made a big difference. I think it did, obviously. But that was an amazing. As I've said to everybody, the one game I'm taking to my grave with me is that one. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, obviously, your time at Everton was brief, really, in the course of your whole career. I mean, Paul was saying just before we came on, about 19 months, really, in total, nearly two seasons.
Yeah, 20 months.
Yeah. Obviously, Gary Lineker joined Everton in the summer 1985 and you rejoined Aston Villa. What were the circumstances around that? Like, what happened first? Was Lineker brought in and then you were pushed out? Was it something you wanted to stay? How did it work?
I've said this only recently and it's true. I shouldn't have left Everton. I shouldn't have left. But when we've had the season we had, and as you say, we were a whisker away from winning the treble. Had we not been tired, and I mean empty, had we not been running on empty, we'd have beat United in the FA Cup final. We were better than them. And we'd gubbed them that year, and we'd gubbed them two or three times that year. So we all felt we could beat them, but we had nothing left in the tank, a lot of us. And so I'm sitting there in the summer, we're moving house, and we're unpacking boxes. And I saw Howard's Jag pull up outside the new house just moved. And I said to my girlfriend at the time, I wouldn't be unpacking any more bags, love. She went, what do you mean? I said, well, the gaffer doesn't come and visit you in the close season with good news. And she went, oh, no. I said, yes. So Howard was good as gold. He could come in. I knew he's normally Howard. He was up bubbly, but he was nervous and he was agitated. And I could tell there was something on his mind. And he says, how are you? I said, how am I? How do you think I am? You know, we just won what we've won over the last 2 years. Brilliant club, amazing fans, great players. How do you think I am? He says, okay, I just wanted to ask you, he said, because I've had an offer from Villa. I said, so what? What do you want me to do about that? He said, well, I just thought because it was Villa, you might want to hear it. I said, come on, boss. You want me to leave here? You want me to leave here? After what we've just achieved in 2 years, and go to Villa? Seriously? He went, no, I thought that. We could talk about a new deal, And so I opened a bottle of wine, and we had a couple of glasses of wine. And he said to me, it was just that if you wanted to go, I've got a chance of buying Gary Lineker. But if you're not going, well, it's no problem. It's okay, not a problem. I said, well, do you want me to go? And he says, no, it's good. I said, are you sure? I said, I'll go. I'll make it easy for you. I'll go. He said, no. So after about another glass of wine, he says, well, I'm going to buy Lineker anyway. I went, okay, now we're getting somewhere. And he's, I said, so what does that mean for me? He said, well, I'm going to start with Sharpie and Lineker at the beginning of the season. And what I should have done was absorbed it, took it in, waited a week, 2 weeks, spoke to Reedy, Sharpie, people that had been there, and asked them what they thought. But I just said, okay, I'll go. And he says, no, you don't have to. I said, no, I'll go. I said, I can't stay here and play reserve football or whatever it was after the season we've just had. It's just impossible. And that was my pride, because I was hurt that he felt that I couldn't do it, obviously. And he was, listen, I've got no argument with him buying players, younger players, better players even, if you like. You know, what happened to John Bailey, happened to Kevin Richardson and Alan Harper. You know, they brought in Brandon Howe, they brought in Paul Bracewell. You know, Terry Curran got pushed out when he was there and it was just beginning. So I wasn't bothered. But what I should have done is stayed, because I loved it there. And I should have accepted that at 20, coming up 30, with the injuries I'd had, my time at the top level was going to be limited. But I could still have contributed to Everton in bits and pieces in the dressing room, coming on as a sub, playing the odd game. And I would have loved it. So, but I made the mistake of letting my pride cloud my decision. And because it was Villa, and I knew everybody there and what have you, I went, and it is a huge mistake. I never had the chance to say cheerio to Paul and the likes, because it was close season. I never had the chance to say cheerio to the boys because it was a close season. It was a really strange time for me. And I felt really weird when I left. I felt kind of empty, that I wasn't able to do that. And I think I ended up writing an open letter to the Echo. And they printed it just to, you know, my thoughts, my feelings, my thanks. But I never had a chance to say goodbye to the boys until, and in fact, the first time I saw the boys was when we played them, when I was playing for Villa. So it was strange, but I shouldn't have gone. And if I had that decision to make again, I would definitely have stayed.
Andy, would you say that was your worst moment in football? What with how Kendall came out and let you know that Lineker was signing?
Well, club football, yeah. I mean, the worst moment in football was not getting to a World Cup. I think we've talked about that earlier. That's horrendous for me. But in club terms, yeah, because I didn't see it coming. You know, when you've done what we did, and it's like 2 weeks after the FA Cup final, when we've nearly created history for Everton. And we have created history for Everton because we've become the only, not only got to a European final, but won one. So we are in the history book. So when something happens, like when you're flying, of course I was flying. Every one of us that summer must have been up here somewhere. And when the gaffer comes within 2 weeks of that, and suddenly it's like, you know, it's like taking all the air out of a balloon. It's just, that's the way it was. It just left me... And I was gutted. I have to say, I was gutted that I had to leave. I really was.
As we were as well, Andy. I mean, one thing always occurred to me was...
I know that, Paul, because I still have them in storage somewhere where we got it. I must have got thousands of letters. I mean this, from everybody. And the one that's always tickled me was... Bab Labs about Andy Gray and all that. He said, you know what, I love Andy that much that if I came home one night and he was in bed with my missus, I'd tuck him in to make sure he'd catch a cold. That was a level.
But you mentioned the esteem you're held by Everton fans of all ages. I mean, I've got your book here, Shades of Grey from the mid-80s, and you've actually got a couple of poems in it that the Everton fans wrote about you, singing your praises that you kept and put in the book, which is absolutely brilliant. One thing that always occurred to me was, do you think because of the European ban, that if we'd been allowed to compete in Europe, that Kendall might have wanted you to stay as a backup because we were playing so many more games. And in some indirect way, did the European ban actually influence his thinking and letting you go?
No, in fairness, I mean, he didn't let me go. He asked me if I wanted to. If I'd have said I'll stay, I think he would have said it. But the ban, the European ban, was an absolute... Listen, forget the human cost. We know what that was like. That's horrific. That's horrific. But for a club like Everton, who have been nowhere near it since, those mid to late 80s, have been nowhere near it since, it was a tragedy and a travesty that I don't know. Am I close to saying the best ever team Everton have ever had?
I don't think I'd argue with that. It's the best one I've seen.
Well, it must be close. It must be close. I mean, I can only think.
I think as well, I mean, my dad, who, you know, been watching support the club since the 1930s, he always said the 84-85 team was the best team we ever saw. And he'd seen the 62-63 team as well.
Yeah, I think to be denied at the height of their powers, the opportunity to win a European Cup is hard to take. And it should be hard to take for any Evertonian. Certainly hard for me to take. Having done what we've done and won what we did there, and that being the first of two league titles in 3 years, I've absolutely no doubt in my mind we would have won a European Cup. I've no doubt in my mind about that. There was nobody better than us. The only team that could touch us was Liverpool. And we'd already shown that we were capable of beating them. You know, I think the other teams in the Europe weren't as strong as us. The Bayern Munich coaches went away mouth open thinking, fucking hell. They were actually quoted as saying, this is a different kind of football. They have taken this to a new level, their fitness. And, you know, but it was true. And they were right. They couldn't catch their breath with the fitness levels we had at that late in the season and that kind of game. So we had done that. And I think the only team that could have touched us was Liverpool. I mean that in Europe. So I think we would have won a European Cup in one of those years. I really do. And I think, you know, had we still been there, then that might have made a difference. It would have made a difference to me. Of course it would. Of course it would.
Now, post-Everton then, as you say, you moved back to Aston Villa, which possibly wasn't the best of seasons for you. And then moved to West Brom, which was probably happier because the goals were flowing again back with West Brom. But then following that, I guess it's the fulfilment of a childhood dream and playing for Rangers. And as you said at the start, quite rightly, a Scottish title came along there. Obviously, this is something that, you know, as we talked about at the start, this is your boyhood club. This is, you know, what a place for you to sort of round out your career at the top level. So what did that move mean to you at that time? And obviously the fact that it was a successful move as well, you know, you could contribute to... obviously the start of an incredible run for Rangers. You were in at the start of all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, start of nine in a row, first of the nine in a row. It was an amazing spell. It was strange, but wonderful in respect that I had, you know, before I'd signed for Everton, I remember when I was at Wolves thinking, that's me, I'm done. I honestly thought that was it. I was like 27, coming up 28. And I actually thought my best days had gone, and that was it. I wasn't going to win anything again. Wolves are dreadful. Everton revived me, no doubt about that, and gave me two of the most glorious years a footballer could ever have. And then Graham Taylor came to Villa. Remember Graham? God rest his soul. And he was a bit like Saunders, and he pulled me in. The very first day he was there at Villa, he called me into his office and he says, sit down, Andy. I said, all right, boss. He said, I'm going to have to let you go. I said, what? He says, I'm going to have to let you go. I said, really? He says, yeah, you're too powerful in the dressing room. I went, am I? He went, yeah. I said, well, isn't that a good thing? Can't you use that? You know, if I influence the players in a positive way. No. I like to have control of everything, Andy. And you, I said, all right. I said, I appreciate you telling me. And then Big Ron phoned me. And now he asked me, he said, I've had an offer from Birmingham City. I said, what do you think? I said, sorry? Birmingham City. I said, you expect me to leave Aston Villa and go to Birmingham City? I says, think again, Graham. No. And Big Ron phoned me about a couple of weeks later and said, listen, need your help. Why don't you come over? and help me out here, struggling team, I think they're on second division then. He says, come over. He says, I can do your help here. And I said, and I love Big Rod. He's great. And I've been a pal of his for since the mid-70s when he was manager of West Brom the first time. When he had that great side of Batson and Cyril Regis and Laurie Cunningham and the likes. And I says, okay, I'll come over. Brilliant. And I had a really good year there. You know, scored a few goals, good few goals, and helped run out in the training and what have you. And then the following season, I get, he calls me at home and he says, right, are you sitting down? I said, yeah, what's the matter? He said, who have you always wanted to play for and never had the opportunity to do? I went, fuck me, Real Madrid haven't come in for me, have they? My God. And he went, that was just stupid. He said, Real Madrid. Well, I didn't want to say Rangers, but I said, sorry. He says, your knee's shot. He said, you've failed every medical you've ever had. He says, no. He said, Sue's been on the phone. I said, tell him I'm on the way. And I went up, and as I said to everybody, like, it was the cherry on the icing on the top of the cake. That was it. And it was that for my family as well. I mean, Graham didn't want me to move up. He said, just fly up every Thursday, come for a couple of days training if I need you. I just want you in the dressing room. We've got to start winning things again here at this club, and I want you around. And I played, and we won the title, and I got my medal and scored goals for the club. Like as Paul would know about Everton, that I loved and I've supported as a kid. And to finish there, winning the title was just, it couldn't have ended any better. It couldn't have ended any better, really. And you know, it was brilliant. It's the only way to describe it.
Now, obviously, post that, there was a brief stint with Cheltenham, but I guess your top-level career was done then. And there was a change of tack. You know, once the playing days were done, your career took off in a whole new way, being beamed into homes across the land, key part of Sky Sports Premier League coverage, as everybody will know, obviously, as a co-commentator and a studio analyst. Now, how did it all start off with Sky, and how did it feel for you to be part of something that was a complete revolution in terms of football coverage? I mean, people nowadays may not quite appreciate the difference it was in the early 90s, mid-1990s as well, of how Sky changed television coverage of football. What a big difference it was. And obviously you were a fundamental part of that.
Yeah, I mean, to cut a long story short, the guy who was put in charge of BSB, as it was at the time, wasn't Sky. I was working for British Satellite Broadcasting. If you remember, there was two satellite companies. So a guy from Aberdeen, Andy Melvin, who was the brains behind it all, he was asked to put a team together. He knew me from things I'd done on TV, and he actually liked the way I sounded, the way I did things, the way I talked, and he thought I could make a good co-commentator. So he asked me, and I was doing nothing. It was coming up to the beginning of the season, 89, middle of 89, middle of 89? Yeah, I think the middle of 89. And I went and met them, and I was excited by what they said and what they planned to do. So I joined, and I worked in a lot of Scottish football to start with, in the FA Cup, that's all we had. And I cut my teeth there, and he taught me, and he was my mentor, Andy, and about the nuances of working, you know, behind a microphone. So I learned a lot from him, and I had about a year and a half with nobody really watching us, because there weren't many squareos around in those days, if you can remember back. So I was kind of getting a schooling, but with no great judgment being levelled at me. And then when the merger happened and Sky took over BSB, I was with Big Ron at Villa as Ron's assistant, and Sky won the battle for the Premier League, and they phoned me up and said, you need to make a choice. We want you full time at Sky. We want to do all our co-coms, but you won't be able to do that and Villa. And I knew that, and I went and saw Big Ron. He says, you've got to go. He says, it's a brilliant opportunity. I said, this is going to be, he thought it was going to be massive. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people thought it would crash and burn. But Ron did it. Ron had done a lot of TV. He knew his stuff. He knows his stuff. And he thought it was going to be massive. He says, Andy, it's a great opportunity. Great opportunity. He says, in this job I'm in now, who knows how long I'm going to be here? And it won't be my choice. Somebody else will sack me. And then who knows? But you go. So I did. I jumped ship from Villa. And I joined Sky full time at the first season of the Premier League. Was it 1992? And off we went. And it truly was a whole new ball game. There's no doubt about that. I mean, stuff we tried was pathetic. You know, there were a lot of gimmicks that came in. But the people who were influencing the decision makers were people who loved football, like Andy Melvin, like myself, like Richard Keys, like Martin Tyler, you know, all these people who loved the game. And we did love the game. So we weren't interested in gimmicks for gimmicks' sake. You know, the clock in the corner now, you can't ever think you could watch a football match without having that clock in the corner, can you? You can't. You'd walk in and you'd go, how long's gone? Where's the clock? You know, little things like that we added, and, you know, numbers on the names and numbers on the shirts, squad rotation and all those sort of things. Things we tried, like, you know, it was, you know, the halftime Monday night football with the Sky Strikers, the girls dancing pre-match, and then you had this entertainment at halftime. You know, we came up with Monday night football that developed after a couple of years. Andy Melvin came to me and said, I want you to stop doing commentary on a Monday night. I thought, oh, okay, why? He said, because I want to bring you in studio. I said, I want to create a new show called Monday Night Football, based around you and Keezy, and videos and analysis. And I went, okay, you know, you've never been wrong so far. So we did, and it was brilliant. It was an amazing journey. It was absolutely amazing to be at every big game and to watch so much football. And you know, when you're at the inception of something, it's, I always think it's special then. You know, you can say, I was there. The guys that have followed me, they've done a great job in their own way, but they weren't there at the beginning. And they've just taken on what we gave them and what we started and how we did it. And to be there then, for the likes of me and Martin Tyler, Richard Keys, Jeff Shreves, all these kind of people who still in the game, still working, to still be there as something special, something special.
I think as well, Andy, I mean the achievements that you did there, because at the time the idea of paying to watch sports on TV was alien to most people. So not only did you have to establish a reputation as being a good commentator, you also had to convince people to pay out money to watch something they thought they got for free in the past. And I think people don't appreciate that now, because pay TV is a norm. Like, you pay for so many different subscriptions at the moment. But when you first came through, you know, with Sky, the idea of paying to watch football on TV, you know, and the press were totally against it as well. I mean, Sky got such a battering from the press when it first started. I think history would judge that period of the time as, you know, the way Sky's coverage of football and your commentary and presentation and technical skills just revolutionised how people would consume football.
But don't think I knew what I was doing there with those technical skills, because I would walk in on a Monday morning and go into Andy Melvin's office to talk about the night, and he'd say, right, I've got a piece of kit here. I said, all right. I said, what will you use it next month? He went, no, tonight. I said, but I've never seen it before. He said, well, go and have a look at it now. And it's amazing. It's like the boot room, which was an innovative little show we did, and he thought up, and it became unbelievable watching for people in the game. And that was a Sabuto board. I don't remember. It was a Sabuto board. And I used to sit and walk up the dressing room with guests. But that came through Andy Melvin, me, and a couple of others were up in Glasgow, and we were after a Rangers-Celtic game or something like that. We're sitting in the Holiday Inn, having a few bottles of beer. There was a lot of bottles on the table, as you would imagine. And he said to me, what's the difference between a back four and a back three? And I've gone, right, I'll tell you, give me those bottles. So we took the bottles out, we cleared the table, and I started doing this. And clever as he is, he logged it away, Melvin, in the back of his brain, and he thought, oh, I like that. And then 18 months later, he went, remember that night in Glasgow? I went, which one? He says, the one where you showed me about this. I said, yeah, yeah. He said, well, I want you to do that next season on TV. I went, you're joking. He said, no. We're going to call it the boot room, and we're going to sit you there, and we're going to get somebody in. And what I always insisted, though, was that I always used to say, don't bring me anybody who's working in the Premier League, because they won't tell you anything. You know, if you bring in somebody who's a coach for, you know, Aston Villa, and you say, well, tell us how you play, they're not going to say, oh, okay, then this is how we play. No, so I always said we need to bring people in who are in the lower leagues, but who know football, like Glenn Hoddles of this world. Glenn was a brilliant guest on that. He was manager of Swindon, I think, at the time. And he was brilliant. I could talk to Glenn all day. And we brought in loads of people like that. And it became hugely popular. And it was a great little show. A great little show for nothing. But it was wonderful. It was such a good journey to be on that one. And the success, I mean, as you say, initially, it's a bit like getting free milk at school, you know, for 6 years. And then all of a sudden, you're going to have to pay for it. You think to yourself, well, hold on a minute. I've had free milk for 6 years. Why am I going to pay for it now? You know, it was a bit like that. Football was free all our lives. And all of a sudden, you've been asked to pay for it. But I think when you saw what you were getting for your buck, it wasn't extortionate. At least, I don't think it was. I can't remember. But I don't think it was extortionate for the amount of football you were seeing compared to what you did see. Because remember, we hardly ever got a live game ever back in the day. I mean, when I was a kid, the only live game I ever saw was the FA Cup final. I mean, that was basically it. You know, you never got a league game live. So we did change it and we did move, but I think it worked because we cared. The guys who ran it cared.
It definitely made football football watching on television a social activity in the early days, because as you say, yes, not that many people had the subscriptions then. So yes, it was a pub activity, but yeah, and it grew and grew from there. But it's about the quality of what the coverage is, as you rightly say, Andy. That's why it's revolutionised it, but that's why it equally caught on. And you can see all the echoes of that in the coverage still now, of how it's done, the additional analysis, all the Monday night shows. It's not that different from what you did 30 years ago now.
It's just the tech is up to speed now. The tech is 21st century. I mean, when I started, I had a thing like a light pen. It was called a Telestrator. And I would draw circles and arrows on the screen. And everybody used to say, you don't put those tapes in that machine. So that was a compliment to us and me. I used to have these loads of tapes that I'd spent the day picking out. I used to put them in the machine and start them, and then I would do the Telestrator. Everybody used to say, you don't do that. I said, well, who do you think does it then? No, somebody in the back does that. That's a dummy tape you're putting in there. I said, trust me, it's not. And Andy Melvin said to me, what you need to do one night is mess up big time. He said, put a tape in that's rewound to the end, or stop it somewhere where you shouldn't, and they'll know it's you that's doing it. So, but they never used to believe it was being done like that. But it was really good fun.
Andy, can I just ask that? So obviously Sky went really well. You established there. You know, the viewing figures are increasing. You know, you've established the Premier League, and then Everton approached you in 1997 to see if you're interested in becoming the manager. How did that kind of unravel? How did that develop? And how tempted were you?
Well, hugely tempted. At the time, I was still young. It was Everton, and I got a call that Peter Johnson would like to see me. And when I left home, I said to my girlfriend at the time, well, I think when I come back, I'm going to be manager of Everton. I really believe that, because Everton had been without a manager for about 3 months. Dave Watson, Waggy, was in charge. Hadn't had a manager. Yeah, they were coming up to the beginning of the season, pre-season, still hadn't that manager in. So I didn't think they'd be dragging their feet when they asked to meet me. So I went up to Park Foods. Was it Park Foods in the Wirral, where Johnson used to have? I think it is. And I met them. Yeah. So I met them, and we talked for hours about what might do if you were manager of Everton, and if this, who would you bring in? What would you bring in? What would you do? And we talked for ages, and I thought, okay, that's pretty much done. And then they said to me, okay, Peter Johnson said, we'll let you know. We've got another couple of people to talk to, which I found really strange, because I thought if they wanted me, they'd just said, and I probably would have signed the damned what happened with Sky and just thought, get on with it. But he let me go, and I went on holiday with a load of ex-pros to play golf. And he said to me, Andy, this talks will remain private. I said, not a problem, Peter. I'm going away for 5-6 days, so I won't be talking to anybody. But he kept drip-feeding stories about the meeting all that week in the press, to, because he was under enormous pressure to appoint a coach. And I never once picked up the phone and offered me the job. And eventually when I got back from the golf trip, Sky obviously had heard wind of Everton's interest and went out their way. Surprisingly, in those days, they went out their way to keep me, unlike later. But they went out their way to keep me. And I signed a deal with them. And up to this day, never once did Peter Johnson pick up a phone and say to me, I want you to be manager of our club. And those are the true facts. Had he done so when I went up there to his factory, I'd have done it. But after having 10 days and nothing from him, I signed a new deal with Sky, and that was the end of it. That was the end of it. So I think it was obviously right club, but I do think wrong time. I don't think the Peter Johnson era was a good one for us. You know, in hindsight, it probably was the right decision that I didn't go then.
Would you ever like to be in a football manager?
Yes, I think. Yes, I think's the answer. I mean, it's not far away, but one day when I'm sitting in the rocking chair and just got nothing to do, even as I say, far away, I might just sit and wonder if I could have. I mean, a lot of people who know me think I would have been a good coach, but I don't know. You never know. You know, there's been some really good players who have not made good coaches. There's been some really poor players or ordinary players that have made great coaches. So you don't know. But, you know, I probably would like to have tried it. Yeah. I know what it's like to win things as a player, but I don't know what it's like to win things as a manager. When you've done everything, you've organised the tactics, you've picked a team, you've made the substitutions when and are they important enough and was it the right time? And then you win something. Like, I'd love to know what it felt like to be Fergie, you know, when you win those things that he won. But I never will. But I don't sit here and worry about that. But yeah, I think in my latter life, I might just think, I wonder if I'd have been any good. But we'll never know that. We'll never know that.
Right, I'm going to finish things off, Andy, with a bit of a quick fire round for you, okay? Quick answers, first thing that comes into your head. So, best goal you ever scored?
Best goal I ever scored? Scottish Cup semi-final replay at Hampden against Hearts when I was at Dundee United. I scored a magnificent chest and volley into the top corner from the edge of the box. That takes some beating. But apart from that, there are a couple of headers at Goodison that take a bit of beating as well, I have to be honest. But that one's up there, that one, early on in my career.
Okay, favourite strike partner?
Sharpie.
The best manager you played for?
Howard Kendall.
Most difficult opponent?
The Taxman.
fantastic. Your best friend in football?
Wow. My best friend in football? I would have to be Reedy.
Any regrets in your football career?
Yeah, only never playing in a World Cup finals.
Favourite person to have a drink with?
Reedy.
One word to describe yourself?
Competitive.
And the favourite city you've lived in?
Glasgow.
I think Paul wants you to say Liverpool. Glasgow, there you go.
Very similar cities, Andy.
They are. I said that the other night. I was up in Liverpool. I was up in Liverpool the other night doing a couple of games for Evertonians last Friday. And I said that when I arrived there all those years ago and I got in for a couple of weeks there, I said to somebody, I can't believe how like Glasgow this is, apart from the accents. I said, you know, a city built on the river, two iconic football clubs in the same city, humour from the people who live in that city. It was just like Glasgow. It reminded me so much of Glasgow.
Okay, final one then, Andy. What advice would you give the young 17-year-old Andy who was starting his career in football, if you could talk to him somehow?
My advice would be the best you can possibly be and never be satisfied with what you achieve.
Well, we better wrap things up there before we take all of your evening, Andy. So any final thoughts, Paul, before we sign off?
Yeah, I mean, it's I can listen to Andy for another 2 hours. It's been a fantastic evening. So much insight. So much, learned so many different things. Like you think you know everything about someone's career, then you come on the show tonight and give you so many different stories and background to events that happened in their career. It's been absolutely fascinating from start to finish. And I love Andy's brogue. I love the accent. I can listen to that voice all day long. And obviously, you know, talking to somebody who, you know, when I was growing up as an Everton fan, literally transformed the fortunes of the club in the space in 19 months. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, guys. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, huge thank you for your time. It's been better than we could have imagined. So, yeah, I'm glad you've enjoyed it too. Thanks for coming on. And thanks for everyone for listening too. Do join us again on the Lob podcast. I can't promise we'll have a former player of the year on, but you never know. Thanks very much, everybody, and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.